It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
Perhaps no one symbolized the Eastern Shore poultry industry more than Frank Perdue. Many Americans knew him as the man who told television audiences around the nation that it takes a tough man to make a tender chicken. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. He was a legend on the shore, and for the many who worked for Perdue Farms, he seemed to be everywhere and could telephone at any time, day or night. Born in the 1920s, he saw his company rise to become a giant in the chicken industry. He died in 2005, leaving the running of the business to his son, Jim Perdue. So what was he like? There's a new book entitled, appropriately, Tough Man Tender Chicken, Business and Life Lessons from Frank Perdue. And its author is his widow, Mitzi Perdue, who is also well-known on the Eastern Shore in her own right. Welcome to the program.
What a joy to be here, Don.
Well, let me just ask you that the proverbial question is, so what was Frank like?
Oh, my gosh, it would take a whole book to explain it.
I think we got it here. Go ahead.
But nevertheless, I'll make a try at it.
Go ahead.
He was a very complex person, but I was thinking, how do you boil down this whole giant personality? Yeah, a guy who built a company from a father and son operation to one that employed 19,000 people at the time of his passing. Now, what did it take to do that? And I do have a simple answer to that. I think he was a teacher. I think that, he was many, many things. But one of the ways that I think he grew a very, very large company was he'd have a vision and he'd have ideas how to do it. He was brilliant at seeing how to get from here to there. But he'd teach other people what they needed to do to be part of the whole team. And I think he was maybe, I was saying a teacher, but I think there was a coach part of it too. Because, he would not only teach the people who worked with him. And by the way, at Perdue, people would never or would rarely say they worked for him. What you'd typically hear, and I interviewed 134 people for the book, was that they worked with him. So, teacher and coach.
Now, he didn't start out thinking he was going to go into the poultry industry. I mean, he went to college and so on. What kind of impact did his upbringing have then on him as he moved into, I guess, basically the business?
Well, Frank told me that as a teenager, the last thing in the world he wanted to do was go into the chicken industry. He felt that he had had enough of it because he grew up with all the toil and work that it takes to grow chickens. And as a teenager, he didn't like that all that much. He went to Salisbury University, although it was Salisbury State at the time. And in the end, he decided that his career had been sort of, this is strange, but his career had been sort of heading towards becoming a teacher. I mean, he was taking the courses to become a teacher, but then decided that career wasn't for him, although I think in the end he did become a teacher. It's just that he became a teacher businessman rather than a teacher. So after 2 years at Salisbury State, he left and he didn't know what he wanted to do at all. Actually, what he really wanted to do was be a professional baseball player. But he had two little drawbacks for that career, and one was he couldn't hit and the other was he couldn't catch. He said that he drifted into the chicken business because while he was looking for what he would do with his life, he was helping out his dad, and he stayed. And in the end, I think loved it more than he ever imagined.
By the way, did you get any sense about what the impact was on him from his father? Because you indicate that he was a bit of a shy person in some ways, too. I mean,
he started out, actually, till the end of his days, I think he was a shy man. And a lot of the people that I interviewed caught that. He transcended himself, and his father helped him with that because in school, he was a shy person. He was never in a school play, for example. When his father felt that he should overcome the shyness, and Frank endorsed that, his father gave him an assignment selling seed corn. And for somebody who is extremely shy to be a salesman, I mean, this is a pretty big jump. But Frank, in the end, Or actually, let me start out at the beginning. He said at the beginning of his career as a salesman, he was so shy that when he'd be talking with a farmer about buying a particular kind of corn, he would be looking at his feet instead of at his prospect. He just, you know, he was too shy to look at the person in the face even. That's how he started out. How he ended up was he was the largest Beacon feed dealer in the whole country. And how does a very shy person become an extraordinary salesman? And I think the answer, or actually his answer, so I'm not going to say I think, the answer was he felt that he could know the product so well that he could almost be like as if he was on the payroll of his client telling, you know, what would work and what wouldn't work. And he felt that his reputation was behind every recommendation he ever made. So he had to know more than anybody about what corn would do well, you know, when to plant it, just all the details as if he was working for the client.
Yeah, you mentioned that there's a reference to Alexander Hamilton. This is quotes that when I have a subject in hand, I study profoundly day and night. It is before me. My mind becomes pervaded with it. And you seem to think that that's something that Frank basically did all of his life.
Frank, that quotation, he had it memorized, although memorizing wasn't difficult for him because you can't count the number of things it did say by memory. But that particular one, if people were asking him, how did you do it? What made you such a success? And as a modest and shy man, he'd try to mumble and get himself out of even having to answer. But if you really pressed him, he'd say, well, it's the people who worked with me. But if you really, really, really pressed him, he'd give that quote from Alexander Hamilton that some people call it genius, but what success really is the fruit of labor and hard work.
Now, in terms of his personality, was he shy when you met him? Or I mean, I guess one of the questions I have is were there sort of two Frank Perdues in some sense, in the sense that there was a shy person, but that as a salesperson and going out of the public, he was very extroverted or very open. I mean, you get that, by the way, in entertainers. There's a lot of entertainers that exactly that way. They'll be very shy people. Johnny Carson, I think, was. But he'd get on a stage and bang, there he was.
Then I have a Johnny Carson story.
Go ahead.
Because actually, I know firsthand that Johnny Carson was very shy because this is, this happened. It seems a little strange, but nevertheless, it did happen. Frank and I, every year, used to go to Wimbledon for the tennis matches. You know, Frank just loved it, and I grew to love it, too. But one of the great perks of going to the tennis matches at Wimbledon in England is that the big television stations have huge hospitality tents, and they have, you know, some of their most famous stars there. You know, it's a perk for the stars. It's a perk for anybody else who's invited into it. Well, Frank, since we do an awful lot of advertising, would get invited into the tents. And one day, Frank Perdue was sitting at a table, and Johnny Carson came and sat beside us. Ooh, how nice. And they certainly knew of each other. And, you know, the conversation is bubbling along. But then I have to go comb my hair. I came back like 3 minutes later, and there the two of them were just sort of awkwardly like staring into space. And afterwards, Frank said, "No, don't ever leave me like that," because neither of us were good at keeping a conversation going, which is kind of astonishing considering that they were both, at least in the public eye, very outgoing. But in this case, I mean, I'm reporting what I observed happen. By the way, I was a television hostess before this, so and I am not shy. but you know, it was my job to draw people out and get conversations going. So I think that I was possibly an asset to Frank because if I was at his side, there would never be those awkward moments.
So So basically, he sort of transcended this introversion, I guess, than that he had at that point. I mean, do you think he felt more comfortable as he grew older in terms of connecting with people?
I think he was actually positively gifted at connecting with people, but I don't think it came naturally to him. In fact, there was a test that some professor at Salisbury University gave both of us. This was from the business school, And it was a forced choice question where you have to answer, say there are four choices and you have to pick one of them. And it's a little bit like the Myers-Briggs test, but this particular one, they were probably calibrating some new test or something. But they asked us like 20 different parameters of personality, like how punctual you are, how responsible and so forth. And of these 20 parameters where they showed us the results afterwards, Frank and I, we were almost copies of each other. I wasn't as extreme in punctuality or... Mm-hmm. Or any of the other factors, except there was one where we were complete opposites, and it was the one out of these 20 that was telling people, how much are you energized by being with people, and how much does it cost you? You know, how much does it take an effort, or how much does it just, get your engines revving? And I was in like the 98th percentile of just, I love to be in a crowd. I love it. Frank, on the other hand, was like in the bottom 5%. So although he was extremely good at it, it wasn't something that came natural to him.
Now, he seemed to be, and oftentimes he would be ahead of the game. And that's one of the things I think that Purdue, when you look at, particularly comparing Purdue as a poultry company to, say, other poultry companies, you can see the diversification that's taken place that's actually kept it in a goat cape situation. What was it? You have a quote where he says something about that you should try to keep out of your comfort zone. And it sounds to me like he was always kind of trying to move ahead beyond just where he was.
In fact, I almost think that's one of the big, threads in the story of Frank Purdue, which is that he was always transcending himself. I mean, I told you about transcending shyness, which he did, I think, as well as anybody in the country. But he would also transcend himself in, for example, he put huge effort into research. If he was going to, for example, build a feed mill, he wouldn't just get directions of how you build a feed mill. Instead, I've talked with people who said that Frank Purdue interviewed the owners of every feed mill that there was and would ask hundreds of questions. Or when he got into advertising, he did a total 10-week total immersion study of advertising in New York. And one of the things that he did was he joined the Association of National Advertisers for the sole purpose of accessing their library. And so here he is burrowed in the library, reading all the magazines and books that you could possibly find on it. And he didn't just like read them. He would take endless notes. I believe in the NAB Center, at the Purdue Business School, there's examples of the kinds of notes that he would take. Little tiny writing. I'm told that Einstein had little tiny writing. Well, Frank had little tiny writing, and he'd just take endless notes. And he had a very retentive memory, so that by the end of a few weeks of studying advertising, he probably knew more about it than any poultry man ever had. But then that didn't stop him. He went around. He made a grid of New York, and on it he would list the different radio stations, television stations, and major news outlets, newspapers. And he'd go visit each of them, and he'd talk with, say, the sales manager or the advertising manager, and he'd say, what makes a good ad? And then that wasn't enough. But now he knew more than most people about advertising anyway. Then he knew that he needed the help of a professional, and he interviewed 68 different Well, he studied 68 different advertising companies, and he actually interviewed 48 of them. Now, how many people do that much studying? And when he was getting down to like the top 10, he wouldn't just interview them, he'd interview all their clients. So the amount of research that he would put into something, I think, would almost guarantee that he, knowing more about whatever issue was before him, could possibly make a better decision, a more informed decision, a wiser decision, and even a decision that, since it's drawing on more information, is going to be outside of the box.
By the way, I have to ask, so where did this slogan come up about the tough man and tender chicken? How did that come about?
Oh, that was so neat, because when Frank was first getting into advertising, and we're talking like early 70s, like 1971, the man who Frank eventually chose to be the copywriter for the ads is a man named Ed McCabe, and they eventually became good friends until Frank's passing. But Ed McCabe found Frank at the beginning, really, as he put it, how do I say this nicely, on a pain in the...
Okay.
It rhymes with the fish bass.
Right.
Ed found Frank such a pain in the... that he said, he told Frank, I don't know if I even want your business because you're such a pain in the...
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, they did decide to work together, and Ed McCabe said, you know, you're asking for something that hasn't been done before. You want to advertise a commodity, and, you know, the received wisdom in all of advertising is that that's money down a rat hole. It doesn't make sense to advertise a commodity. And McCabe said, part of the reason for that is whatever we say about your chickens, you know, like they're fresh or they're fed well or whatever, your competitors can say, well, mine are fresh, mine are fed well. There's, you know, there's nothing that we can say about your chickens that doesn't apply or that your competitors can't copy. And then he said, looking at Frank, you know something? There's one thing that your competitors can't copy, because you look like a chicken, you squawk like a chicken, you sound like a chicken.
How did he react?
Oh, Frank thought it was the funniest thing in the world. He was always laughing about that.
So then it sort of came about, yeah.
Oh, well, we're now at the point where Frank will be the spokesperson.
Right.
And initially, by the way, Frank, well, you asked how he reacted to be told that he looked like a chicken. He was fine with that. But what he wasn't fine with is he didn't want to star in them because, as he told Ed McCabe, and as Ed McCabe even knew, Frank was a shy man. Frank had never even been in a school play. To the end of his days, he was never comfortable public speaking. He didn't want to do it. But since there was this issue of what's the one thing that your competitors can't copy, they can't copy you. So now Ed McCabe is looking at, you know, what is characteristic of Frank? Well, he'd watch how tough Frank was in say, the processing plants or with his associates. You know, he really was a tough and demanding person. And Ed McCabe said, that's what makes your chickens great. You are really on all the details. You're a tough man. And so that's how was born It Takes a Tough Man to Make a Tender Chicken.
So when he's looking out at his employees, he seemed to be obviously everywhere. And I've heard stories about people getting calls in the middle of the night, right?
Oh, totally.
Well, did he ever sleep? I mean, what was his that personal regimen like? Because it sounds like he just never slept.
Well, actually, that was when we married. I almost believe in reincarnation, because when we married, we hadn't known each other very long. It was actually 6 weeks and 3 days. Oh, yep.
Okay. All right.
But I felt that as if I'd known him forever. There was no adjustment period. I just felt that I was totally comfortable with this man, with one exception. I could not believe how little he slept. He was he would be perfectly fine with 5 hours, and sometimes 4 hours, and sometimes two or three. He didn't need sleep on the scale that other people do. And this is totally astonishing to me, because, I mean, even in retrospect, it's astonishing to me, because my career these days is I'm a science writer. I work for the Academy of Women's Health, and I work for Genetic Engineering and Biotechnology News. And both of these sources, inevitably a lot of health information crosses my desk and I devour it because I can't write my articles without, you know, research. And all the research says that you really need your 7 or 8 hours sleep or you're not going to be healthy. But Frank was a complete total exception to that. He just functioned beautifully with very little sleep.
So I mean, and you interviewed a lot of people. So
134.
How do people react to getting these phone calls in the middle of the night?
Oh, actually, I asked them because, this is not standard practice. and over and over again, I heard from people that in the end they didn't really mind because they liked being part of a winning team. And people have told me that they were just deeply, deeply moved and satisfied and gratified by being with a company that was growing. Yeah, many of the people started out working for just a chicken company. But in the end, it became like international celebrity, and they were deeply proud of that. But they recognized that to get those kinds of results, it took somebody who was on top of all the details. And Frank was famous for being detail-minded. And if there was something, some report that he was interested in, and there was somebody who could give him an answer, he was, I think he didn't process the notion that other people didn't sleep at the same hours that he did.
So how did Frank deal with criticism of his company? I mean, there were been criticism of his company in terms of whether it's workers and so on. How did he personally react? Did he take it personally? Did he, I mean, how, what was, I mean,
Well, I'll tell you a story on that. There was a time, I think we're talking maybe late 80s, maybe early 90s, but probably late 80s, in which there was a story on carpal tunnel syndrome. And I think it was 20 minutes, or maybe it was 60 minutes. Anyway, one of the one of those shows was doing a story on carpal tunnel, because this was, you know, very much what everybody was talking about at this period. And we had the best record in the whole industry. And the way we judge records is our competition would be fined for violations like $2 million, $5 million. We were fined $40,000, which is, you know, that's serious and it's important, but it's not $2 million or $5 million. So we had the best record in the industry. And when, I may have the TV, let's say it's 60 minutes, but stipulating that might not be the right one.
Right.
Okay, 60 Minutes interviews us, and we're expecting, since we have the best record of the industry, Frank could talk about how there was nothing at the moment that was taking more energy from the management committee of focusing on getting this problem solved, because it's a real problem and it's a serious problem, and we recognize that we have to do something about it. And he could also list off what we were doing, you know, education, rotation, changing if you're on the line, changing
up jobs and that sort of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So we were doing a huge amount to remedy the problem, but strangely, 60 Minutes, if that was the one that did it,
or one of them. Yeah.
For this show, instead of talking about all the good things we were doing or why we had the best record in the industry, they were basically talking about how horrible Frank Perdue was. There was a time when when they interviewed Frank, where there was a young man who had had an industrial accident, and the man happened to be African American, and he was 20 years old. Well, Frank is 75 at this point, and to Frank, anybody who is in his 20s is a boy. But so he refers to what happened to this boy. But then Frank's a smart, savvy, sharp person, and he immediately corrects himself because he realizes that referring to an African-American young man as a boy just isn't right. Although, you know, in his frame of reference, he's thinking of the age of the guy. Well, so anyway, he corrects it and says, young man. Well, what 60 Minutes broadcast was none of what we were doing that was right, but Frank Perdue talking about an African-American who had been injured as a boy. And, you know, it just sound like a southern plantation monster. And we were traveling when this aired. We were in a hotel room and watched it. And I was horrified because just the sheer extraordinary injustice of it all, you know, featuring something where he had corrected himself and not telling any of the other side. I was so upset by it that I couldn't sleep all night. In fact, I just, when I'm nervous, I eat. And there was like a 2-pound box of peanuts there. And there I am all night long eating 20,000 calories worth of peanuts. But, you know, in the midst of all this distress over the unfairness and justice of it, I look over at Frank Perdue, who is lying in bed, sleeping sound as a baby. Well, the next morning, he wakes up, and I said, Frank, I couldn't sleep a wink all night. I ate this whole 2 pounds of peanuts. You slept like a baby. How is that? And he said, first of all, if I let things like that bother me, I would have been dead long ago. And second, it probably did some good, because when people are more aware of carpal tunnel, they'll do more about it. So he just didn't take it personally.
How did he view the press? Do you have any sense about how he viewed the press, aside from that incident? I mean, people are wary and some people are not, so I...
Okay, I'm a member of the press, and I was at the time. At the time that we were married, I was working for First Capital News Service and then Scripps Howard. So right. I wrote a weekly column that, you know, every week went to 420 newspapers. So, yeah, you know something really funny? Frank had mixed feelings about society people. Mm-hmm. He marries me, a Boston debutante. He had very mixed feelings about elite schools like Harvard. He would, you know, that was a mark against somebody because he wanted somebody who would, like, really had a more realistic, in-touch education. I'm a Harvard graduate. He liked people who had worked their way up. Well, I was born into the Sheraton family.
Right.
No, I was kind of like the opposite of everything he said that he wanted, but it still worked out. And then on top of that, I'm a member of the press. And I think he liked many individual members of the press, but I think he was aware, as I am aware, that very often what you read, when you know the real story, it's not accurate. Or at least, no, let me retract that. It may be overall accurate, but any story that you know a lot about, you can point to things that the writer didn't get right.
No, by the way, how did he view, by the way, the environmental movement? Because this is sort of a movement that kind of emerges really during his entire lifetime. I mean, 100 years ago, people weren't really thinking about the Chesapeake Bay necessarily a lot and about the environment. We certainly weren't aware of all the things that go into pollution of the bay. And obviously, as time passes, and particularly going into the 1960s and 70s, is much greater concern, a lot of focus on agriculture.
Can I jump in and talk about that?
Yeah, tell me about that.
Okay, one other thing. I think I didn't tell you the title of what I wrote for Scripps Howard. Hmm. It was called The Environment and You. I was an environmental writer. So that meant an awful lot of pillow talk between us. And I think he was extraordinarily sympathetic to the environment. In fact, you know, Purdue today is famous for having eliminated low-dose antibiotics. We're the pioneer in that. We're also the largest producer of organic chicken in the world. I think, yeah, you know, Jim is 99.99%, Jim Perdue, responsible for this. But I think it fell on fertile ground because Frank was in favor of anything that we could do that would help the environment. I mean, he loved national parks. He loved, I would say he was an environmentalist. And I can remember one story. This is how, you know, the press is, things are more complicated than they look, because there was a period, and again, I think we're talking like mid-1990s, where Purdue was having terrible problems getting the wastewater treatment system right. When you have a freeze and it kills some of the microbes that are digesting the wastes, the terrible and sad result of that is that you're being a polluter. Well, Frank hated that. I mean, he didn't want to be a polluter. And I was present at like a lunch where he was talking with the person who was in charge of the wastewater plant. And, you know, Frank could be fairly profane when he chose. And he was really, you know, angry at this man and saying, you know, why don't you fire the person who screwed up? And then I heard the other side, which was, there was an African-American woman who had worked for Purdue. She wanted to improve her education, and she'd actually gotten a degree. And I think we partly paid for her degree in whatever it takes to run a wastewater treatment. I don't know exactly what you study to do that, but she'd studied it, and she was credentialed, and she was now running this. And The view of the manager was, you don't just fire somebody because they screwed up, even if they screwed up big, if they're really trying and it wasn't entirely their fault. And then he went on to say, this woman has three children. And so, yeah, the press was kind of demanding that heads roll, and Frank was upset because he didn't want to be part of polluting. But then there's the human side that you don't just fire people willy-nilly. I mean, their lives at stake on this. And, oh, that reminds me of a story. I think Frank was a very, very caring person. And would you like to know about our honeymoon? Our wedding night, even?
Here goes.
Our honeymoon was in Positano, Italy. And I noticed that Frank was setting his alarm for 3 in the morning on our wedding night. And, you know, I'm asking Frank, why are you setting your alarm for 3 a.m. on our wedding night? And he said, because there's a phone call that I have to make. And the only person who can handle this, the only time I can get hold of him between meetings that he's in New York, is New York time. I think it's like 10 or 9 or something. And I have to speak to him. And I said, gee, what's so important that you would wake up at 3 a.m. on your wedding night too? And it turned out that it was about how an employee was being treated. And I thought, oh, this is really admirable. I mean, that he'd be so caring to do this. And then I asked, who is this person who's so important that you're willing to go to this effort to make sure that his case is handled fairly? And Frank told me that the man was a carpenter in the Accomack plant. Now, how many CEOs of a Fortune 500 size company would interrupt their wedding night to make a phone call to make sure that a carpenter's case was handled fairly? I thought it was awesome.
How do you judge the difference between Jim Perdue and how he runs the company and his personality as opposed to Frank? And obviously they're coming at the company from two different places. Frank's coming at it from building a small tiny company. Jim's already now got this gigantic company, and how do you compare the two in terms of their styles?
Okay, I have a theory that if Frank is up in heaven watching Jim, that he's doing cartwheels of joy. Because in the family, we often talked, Frank talked, the sisters talked, even Jim talked about how it takes a different personality to run a company that's already established versus to build it from scratch. And Frank was hard charging. He didn't have a degree in management. He did a whole lot of things that I don't think would be acceptable today, but it did build the company, and people were loyal to him and stuck with him. Jim, on the other hand, does have a degree in management. He also has a degree in marine biology, a doctorate, by the way. Jim is much more chain of command, much more process-oriented. And that means that the company, I think, probably runs a whole lot more smoothly under Jim. I'm not sure that Frank would have been able to preside over the company doubling in growth the way Jim has. So I think Jim was exactly the right personality and training for taking over. I would make a bet that Jim wouldn't have built the company, and I would make an equal bet that Frank wouldn't have been that good at continuing the company. So Frank was just divinely lucky to have a son who had the right personality to take over Perdue Farms.
We've been speaking with Mitzi Perdue. She has just written a book called Tough Man, Tender Chicken, Business and Life Lessons of Frank Perdue. And, of course, she is the widow of Frank, and we appreciate you taking the time to speak with us.
It was a joy.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
When you listen to Folk Alley, you experience a tradition that's been handed down for hundreds of years. I'm Elena C., and Folk Alley is a link in the chain that includes the ancient child ballads and the latest releases from your favorite singer-songwriters. Bluegrass, Celtic, Americana blues, and much more. It's all part of the Folk Alley mix. You'll also meet the performers and hear exclusive recordings. So I hope you'll join me each week on Folk Alley.
Saturday night at 8 on WSDL 90.7 FM.
Hi, this is Helen Forster, inviting you to tune into E-Town every Sunday at 7 p.m. right here on WSDL 90.7. Each week, we bring you great live music, in-depth conversation, and inspiring stories about people who are really making a difference. That's E-Town, Sundays at 7 p.m. right here on WSDL 90.7.
Former Delegate Heather Mazur has just gotten off a run for governor last year in the Democratic Party, and she's now considering a run for the Senate seat that we left vacant next year with retirement of Barbara Mikulski. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. She came to campus at Salisbury University to commemorate the Gay, Lesbian, and Straight Education Network's National Day of Silence, that is aimed at ending bullying and harassment of members of the LGBT community, and she joins us this morning. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Don.
Well, before we get to why you're here, what was your reaction to the Religious Freedom business with Indiana and Arkansas, the efforts to expand this to individuals, and the backlash that occurred.
Yeah, it was. It's always unfortunate any time legislators try to use the law to take rights away from people, and that's just fundamentally anti-American. And the backlash was because of that. We are operating in a world now that has grown to respect and appreciate the dignity of every person and every relationship. And we don't want to live in a world where businesses are allowed to discriminate against anyone. This wasn't just backlash on behalf of standing up for LGBT rights. It was backlash for discrimination against anyone. And it was heartening to see the governor of Arkansas see what happened in Indiana and stand in the way of allowing similar legislation to move through in his state. Fortunately, here in Maryland, we've not had to worry about that because we've always stood on the side of fairness and equality in Maryland.
By the way, were you surprised at how quickly there was this backlash, particularly from the business community? And why do you think, say, a governor like Pence didn't realize it was going to come at him?
Well, I never like to assume anything or try to pretend that I know what's in anyone's head. Politically, one might suggest that the governor was responding to a base of supporters in the social conservative side of the Republican Party in his state without thinking through the larger perspective of the black eye that this would create on Indiana being seen as a state that is okay with discriminating against people. And it's not okay to refuse to serve anyone anymore. This is 2015. We went through a very dark period in our country where businesses were allowed to discriminate based on the color of someone's skin. And thankfully, we fought hard and long to make sure that we're not there anymore, and that's something that carries forward for everyone. We're not going to discriminate against people, not just if you're a Fortune 500 company, but also if you're a small business. This is America. Everyone deserves to be protected equally under the law.
So what do you make of the fact that we've got a situation now where just in 2004, we had the opposition to gay marriage being an important ingredient to the reelection of George W. Bush. Now here we are over 10 years later, and this role seemed to be reversed. What do you see in terms of this cultural war that we seem to have at least come out of the 1990s with?
It's been fascinating to be in the middle of it. My wife and I got married in Maryland without any legal rights in 2005. We stood with 100 of our closest friends and family and a leader in our faith and pledged vows to forever. And understanding that marriage is about who you love and that you're making a commitment to each other to enjoy each other's fun times, shoulder burdens, divide up responsibilities, and that the protection that's there under the law is for when times get really tough and challenging, when you need to make life and death medical decisions, if you're going to be able to ride in an ambulance together, if a partner is to die, can you claim the body? Are you going to be protected in inheritance proceedings? Most of the protections that come along with marriage are to protect a relationship when tragedy strikes. And yet what was happening for so long was an effort through those laws to try to prohibit LGBT families from coming together to begin with, but they can't stop us from loving each other. All they can do is make it really hard and challenging in the tough times. Now, when Deborah and I said that we were pledging to forever in 2005, we did it in Maryland in part because we wanted to make a stand on working hard to make sure that one day our state would protect our family and families like ours. We had no idea that it would be done so quickly. The movement has been dramatic. And our generation can't take all the credit. A lot of the support and shift in this has been from generations younger than us. I can tell you in the House of Delegates, where we came very close to winning one in 2011 and had to come back and actually hold the vote in 2012, in the intervening months between those two legislative sessions, I had a number of colleagues tell me very deep personal stories where their high school and college-age children had conversations with them that said, Mom, Dad, and whatever the case may be, I'm really embarrassed that you're not going to be for equality. You're on the wrong side of history on this one. And it was through the conversations with their children that they began to understand this issue differently, and they were able to start seeing through the eyes of love rather than the eyes of fear. And now we have 37 states that recognize and protect same-sex couples. And I think we'll, before long, be in a place where that's across the board, because in the states where they've actually banned it, it's being turned over in the courts and under appeals process. And we're making really, really great progress.
Tell me a little bit about your story and how you came to grips with who you were and coming out. What was that like?
It was very challenging. I grew up in a small rural community of 1,100 people. Everyone knows everyone, and I grew up in a generation and a period of time where being openly gay wasn't acceptable. That hearing slurs like faggot and dyke on the school bus was something that was regular occurrence, and it made you want to hide who you were. And I also was struggling from a religious perspective, and I noted this in my floor speech on marriage equality, that I don't hold it against anyone who struggles coming to terms with this issue, because I, as a lesbian woman, even struggled coming to terms. I was a deeply spiritual, religious Catholic woman, and also openly gay, or at that point closeted, and trying to reconcile how to be okay with being gay. And for me, my coming out story and bringing those two pieces together was sitting and realizing that every time I felt bad about being gay, it was because somebody outside of myself was telling me that it was wrong. It was somebody in community, in society, in the media, within the church infrastructure. But anytime I spent time with myself, my own conscience, my own relationship with God, to really discern who I was and what I was about, the messages that I always got back was, you're made in my image. You're perfect as you are. Love your neighbor as yourself. Don't judge. When I looked at it as an internal issue instead of an external one, I come to understand my own truth. And my own truth wasn't just that I was an openly gay woman. My own truth was that I also had discerned this with my conscience and with my God, and was very, very comfortable being able to reconcile being both Catholic and being gay. And so I came out when I was in college, when I kind of came to that place of recognizing and ending my own internal struggle. And that's why it's so important, and that's why we've seen so much advancement come forward, because people aren't being silent about their own truth anymore. And when we speak to that and we connect with people about who we really are and show that I'm the same person that you loved yesterday, Mom and Dad. I haven't changed. Nothing about me is different, other than you now know I will choose to be in relationship or not with someone that may not be the person you had in mind for me, but I'm going to be happy and I'm going to be fulfilled. And ultimately, as a parent, that's what you want for me, right? And it's a journey for everyone. Everyone comes from a different place. But I think it's helped to see over time. When marriage equality first happened in Massachusetts, sky didn't fall. Nobody is wanting to change the right of a church to have its own teaching and set its own rules over who will and will not have what kind of marriages they'll recognize. We just want to make sure that as far as the state house goes, where we're all taxpayers and there are rights and responsibilities granted through a marriage license, that be taken care of for everyone, regardless of what family you're being raised in.
Now, growing up, did you experience bullying? Did you experience harassment? What was your personal experience with that? Did people suspect, were you accused of being? I mean, what was that like?
Well, I always had a boyfriend, so I wasn't entirely accused of being. But there were things that would, when somebody would want to say something negative towards me, that would come out sometimes. I was a star athlete in my school, and I also volunteered for a local politician that some people thought might be a lesbian as well, and so guilty by association. I wasn't bullied in the way that I know so many other of our teens have had to deal with in terms of external bullying. I did have a decent amount of my own self-hatred related to it, though, which is another form of bullying I think we have to recognize.
Explain that.
Well, when you're deep in the closet, and I'm hoping this is shifting as our relationship in society to LGBT people have shifted, but when I was a kid, it wasn't accepted, it wasn't okay, and to both know that I was and try to deny who I was, try to be something else, not be true to myself, and internalize society's disgust, hatred, telling you that it's not okay, to internalize all of that makes you hate yourself in some ways, hate that about you. Just recently, I was cleaning out my attic and I came across my yearbooks. And I saw something in myself that I was really surprised and shocked at, because I'm a really positive person and I try to love everyone and love everything. And I saw some ugliness that I had written in my own yearbook over the pictures of a PE teacher who was presumed to be a lesbian. And I had forgotten how much I joined in on talking bad about her behind her back with other kids. And it wasn't because I really felt that way towards her. It was a self-protection mechanism to say, well, if I'm making fun of her, no one will think that I'm gay then. But it was also, I was willing to do that and kind of cross my own conscience because of not loving myself fully in that moment. And this is the shift that we're starting to create in our community when we start to love and embrace our children fully, completely, for whoever they are, no matter who they love. The community that I represent, or used to represent in the General Assembly, Tacoma Park, is such a beautiful place because it's a community that before it was okay to be gay, it was okay to be gay. When I was knocking on doors when I ran for the city council in 2002, I had a woman tell me at the doors that she thought I was the best candidate in the race, but she was going to vote for the other candidate because he was Latino and she wanted to support diversity. And I told her how much I respected that being a consideration and not to take anything away from what he brings to the table from that perspective of diversity. But I wanted her to know that I was an openly gay candidate and a diverse candidate as well. And she started laughing and she said, oh, sweetheart, this is Tacoma Park. Being gay doesn't count as diversity anymore. And you know, it really has been a wonderful community to transition from going from, you know, a small town place where it wasn't okay to being in a community where it's embraced. But then over the course of the last decade, watching the entire state of Maryland embrace this in a different way.
Now, you was particularly coming here because of the bullying issue. I was looking at some of the stats, and it says that gay and lesbian teens are 2 to 3 times more likely to be bullied and rather to commit suicide, and that they've been bullied. How serious is this for young teens now?
It's incredibly serious. It's one of the reasons why the It Gets Better campaign was started a couple years ago. It's easy when you're a teen. All of us can remember the angst of being a teen and thinking, you know, turning the drama of your emotions and your experience into this all-encompassing no-win situation. And when you compound that with concerns, frustration, self-hatred about being gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, when you're worried about your sexual orientation or your gender identity and how and whether the world around you is going to embrace you for just being who you are, it's easy to feel like there's no way out but that. And that's what we're working against. And we're starting to, I think, make real strides in helping to shift that culture, both from a larger society that is evolving in a more holistic way to embrace the core of everyone, no matter who they are, no matter who they love, but also from peer-to-peer support where it's not as challenging. I'm not going to say, and I don't know what it's like to be a teen anymore. I do know and have talked to enough teens to know that it is better than when I was a teen. And when I was a teen, it was better than when my parents' generation were teens. We're constantly evolving and making strides. But I don't know that we're ever going to be at a place where this doesn't have to be a concern. And we all should be vigilant about spreading the message of how important it is to watch what we say, not just to LGBT teens, to everybody. Our words carry so much power, so much meaning, and can devastate people in ways that we can't even imagine. And when we embrace someone, everyone, from a place of love rather than fear, we're going to have a much better, stronger world.
What do you say to, or what recommendation do you give to, say, teachers, for instance, who find situations where for instance, a teen maybe will be bullied because he's gay? I read about one instance in which the teachers struggle between, on the one hand, trying to deal with the harassment, on the other hand, trying to stick up for the rights of the particular teen. And they really found this a difficult process. What recommendation do you have?
Most teens going through this situation, if they're seeking out an authority figure to have a conversation with, the first thing that they're looking for more than anything else is unconditional love. That's something they're not giving themselves in the moment, and it's something that they fear everyone around them is unwilling to offer, whether it's their parents, their guardians, their religious leaders, teachers. They're looking for someone in authority to give them a hug, to hold them, tell them it's okay, that they are perfect just as they are, and that it gets better. And that unconditional love is the most important piece, and then you build from there.
Brother Finley, so are you going to run for U.S. Senate?
I was going to correct that before the segment was over.
Yes.
I did announce last week that I am not going to run for the Senate, not because it wasn't something I was uninterested in. I definitely took a long pause to consider it. To carry on the legacy of Barbara Mikulski's work in the United States Senate would be a great honor. And the supporters that were behind my enthusiastic run for governor last year spoke strongly, encouraging me to get in this race. And ultimately, while I decided I would really enjoy the job, the work, I didn't want to have to audition for it for the next 2 years. I'm still recovering from having given it my all in a grueling statewide race, less than a year ago. And not quite at the place where I have the capacity to give of myself in such a big way again. So I'm passing on this opportunity, but will forever stay engaged in the issues that matter most to me.
You going to run for elective office again, you think?
I have no idea. I'm very, very comfortable embracing the unknowing and just letting life unfold as it should.
Mm. Are you optimistic, by the way, about the state and its direction? Obviously, we have a Republican governor, but...
I'm always optimistic about Maryland because we are a great state full of amazing, talented people that will always rise to the occasion. This legislative session that is ending this evening, tonight is the last night of the 90-day legislative session, has been a somewhat rocky one. A lot of budget contention between the legislature and the governor's office, even though the legislature itself has been in remarkable agreement. The House passed a compromise bipartisan budget with 129 votes. The Senate passed the same budget unanimously. Strong bipartisan consensus on how to put together a consensus budget. And then the governor's office has been working to reject that approach. So it's been there's been some frustrating and also some bright lights of cooperation happening in the legislature. And as I say, Maryland will always come around to doing the right thing.
Quickly, do you miss it?
That's a complicated question. I'm very much enjoying more time with my family. I'm farming here on the Eastern Shore. My wife and I have a 34-acre farm in Kent County in Chestertown, and it's kind of hard to beat that life. But I also always love having the opportunity to have a seat at the table, make a difference on the issues that I care deeply about, and try to create community transformation. But as I've always known, you don't have to be elected in office to be able to make that kind of impact. And so I'm real happy with where I am right now.
We've been speaking with former delegate Heather Mazur, and she's decided not to run for the U.S. Senate, but no doubt we'll still keep engaged. And we appreciate, by the way, you stopping by and talking with us.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you, Don.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC-14.org.